Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. In 2013, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Montana, then a non-for-profit corporation, was sold to a private corporation. Under state law, the sale assets were transferred to a charitable trust named the Montana Healthcare Foundation, or MHCF, to be managed for the public benefit. Today, MHCF has roughly $80 million in assets. If you were in charge, what would you do with the money? Dr. Aaron Warnham has some ideas. He's the foundation's chief executive officer. Aaron, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Brian, thanks very much for having me.
Where'd you grow up? What'd your folks do?
Grew up in Berkeley, California. My mom was a single mom and worked full-time doing a variety of jobs from cleaning houses to working in a sandal shop.
You went to school in Berkeley?
I did. I went to school at Berkeley High School, actually left school a couple of years early, and climbed rocks and worked as a carpenter for quite some time.
When you left high school, what lessons had you learned either from your time in Berkeley or from your mom that still stick with you?
I guess if I had to pick one, it would be learning how to follow something that I'm passionate about and work hard on it.
And did you get that from her?
Definitely from her.
So what led to medicine for you?
I spent quite a few years, as I said, as a carpenter and spending a lot of time in the outdoors and the mountains. I had always loved science. I'd always loved understanding how living things worked and had a number of friends, both in my life as a carpenter and in my life as a rock climber, who had injuries and somehow became interested in medicine through that. Had one very close friend and climbing partner who was an orthopedic surgeon, and I think he probably influenced me a little bit along the way.
So where'd you go to med school?
I went to the University of California at San Francisco.
And graduated when?
In 1996.
All right, that's going on 20 years. What did you do when you got out of med school?
Well, I'm a family physician, so I did a family practice residency at the Contra Costa County Regional Medical Center, and then spent a couple of years there as an attending physician, doing a lot working with young families, delivering babies, that sort of thing.
And I see that from something supplied by your office that you spent time in Alaska in medical practice.
That's right. When my wife finished her residency, she and I relocated to Alaska.
That's a long way from here. What's the story?
I was not a typical kid growing up in Berkeley. For some reason, I had always been fascinated by Alaska and always been interested in living there, and I think that might have been one of the things that drew me together with my wife, who was also very interested in Alaska. So it turned out we had both considered the possibility of working there and both ended up going to Bethel, Alaska, which is out in the far west of the state near the Bering Sea, a town that serves more than 50 Alaska Native villages spread out over a huge portion of western Alaska. Alaska is a very rural, very large state, similar to Montana in many ways, minus the road system. So in Alaska, instead of having a small critical access hospital in every county or town, there are a few hospitals that serve as hubs out in rural Alaska, and people from the villages will travel in to see you, whether it's by snowmobile or sometimes by car along a frozen river in the winter, and frequently by small plane. We were a sizable hospital out in rural Alaska, serving an extremely spread out region.
Sounds like material for a movie or a novel.
Bethel, Alaska is a fascinating and amazing privilege to work in. We learned a ton, had a lot of amazing experiences, learned a lot from our patients.
You say you learned a ton. Give me a couple of examples.
Well, I think one of the things I learned that I've really brought with me to this position is just how important it is to understand the conditions in which your patients live when you're trying to take care of them. I worked with people who lived in villages that had no running water and no sewer system. If you have no running water, your kids are more likely to have respiratory illnesses. And sure enough, we saw an amazing number of kids with pneumonia in the villages and learned just how important some of the basics that we take for granted in the lower 48 can be to health.
The running water, are we talking the disease implications come from lack of sewage disposal?
Sewage disposal, as well as being able to, just basic hygiene, being able to wash your hands frequently. Remember how often we talk about hand washing to prevent flu transmission. Well, if you live in a place that doesn't have running water, it's hard to comply with those recommendations.
So what brings you to Montana and to the foundation?
This was an incredible privilege when I was offered this position. When I first saw the position, it seemed to be a perfect blend of the skills that I've developed over a career both in clinical practice, which I've been talking to you about in Alaska, as well as the work that I've done in public health with tribes and rural communities in Alaska. And the last 5 years, I did a stint working for two national organizations, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trusts, running a national public health initiative that did a lot of its work through making grants. So I saw this position where they expressed a desire to find someone who understood medicine and understood healthcare as well as as prevention and public health, and had some background in grant making. So it was very well matched to my skills and interest, and a state that I have always felt a kinship with, particularly from my time in Alaska.
Now, let's talk about this idea of grant making. You have a pot of money. You could decide how to spend it, let's say, with you and a board of trustees, and I assume you have a board of trustees?
Yes, we do.
We'll talk about that in a second. But you could make decisions, we're going to spend X, Y, or Z. But grant making is an interactive process, fair?
Fair.
You're an experienced guy. What's the advantage with the grant making process over you and your trustees making the decisions?
Well, I think that to really make good grants, you have to understand the community you're making a grant in, and you have to understand their needs at a very personal level. Just like we talked about those villages in Alaska, if you don't really know what's going on in the community, it's difficult to make a grant that's going to effectively address the needs of the community. So we think of the grant making that we do as a partnership. We set up some basic selection criteria, but we really ask communities to tell us, what are your needs? What are your ideas? What do you think you can do to address an important health issue in your community?
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Warnham, who is the CEO of the Montana Healthcare Foundation. The implication of that to me is that the grant-making process brings knowledge to your organization that you and your staff and trustees by itself may not have. In other words, it's an initiative, a proposal coming from people who I presumably live in those communities. Fair?
That's a great observation. That's very much the way that we wrote this call for a proposal. And more than that, our strategic plan, we view these first few years of grant making as part of our strategic planning process too. We've learned a lot about what the health needs are in the state and some really, I think, identified some very good opportunities to address those needs. But at the same time, we know that there is a lot more to understand, not just about what the needs are, but also about who is out there who can do this work and what are the coalitions and groups that are already doing great work where a grant would help them achieve another level of success.
Okay, let's talk about this because you are in the startup phase and we're going to talk about your specific grant opportunities that are currently available, and if any listeners are interested, you have an opportunity to consider participating in that process. But you've just added something that I hadn't thought of. I've looked at part of your strategic plan. It's lengthy. It seems very focused. What's the origin of the strategic plan, and where can our listeners get it if they want to read a copy?
So the strategic plan is on our website at www.mthcf.org. That stands for Montana Healthcare Foundation. And it is lengthy. It reflects a lot of work that the trustees and the staff and I have done over the last year to understand this state and where our money can make the most difference.
In looking at the table of contents, I was struck about the process, it seems, you went through. It included review of, let me just read a couple of things. You had board educational presentations, review of programming and strategy in other U.S. health foundations, research and literature review, and stakeholder discussions. Now, what struck me about that was that's looking at different parts of things which might lead you to reach different conclusions. For example, you might not go into grant making. You might use peer-reviewed literature to drive decisions. Fair?
Fair.
What did you see when you looked at how other U.S. health foundations work? Do they all use grant making? Is there a diversity?
Almost by definition, foundations tend to be grant makers, but there is a lot of other activity that foundations support that can be very beneficial for health. So we've talked a lot, for example, about convening. Sometimes to address an important issue, you really need to bring the stakeholders together. So something that you see foundations do a lot is to convene a meeting on whatever topic seems important. One thing that we've been talking about, for example, is putting together a healthy communities meeting. This is an interesting topic that's looking at the relationship between factors as far upstream from health as economic development, housing, poverty, and how they affect health. There have been a number of these meetings led by Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Federal Reserve around the country.
Did you say the Federal Reserve?
I did. One little-known branch of their work is working with community developers who help address things like housing and poverty, which we know to be risk factors for a lot of the illnesses that are prevalent in this state and others.
It's an interesting thing for me to get my head around. I read, as I say, parts of this, and there's a phrase in there like upstream influences or upstream factors. That's what you're talking about when you talk about poverty, housing, and here there was a reference to transportation.
We have a kind of a problematic term that we use in public health a lot, the social determinants of health. I don't think that really means anything to the general public, but it means a lot to people who are familiar with the research data. I explain it in much more personal terms. When I was a resident seeing patients in a children's hospital in Oakland, California, I had a 4-year-old boy who came in for his third or fourth asthma admission in 2 months. He would come in just wheezing like crazy. You could hear him around the corner when you were walking into his room. And we would put him on maximal doses of asthma medicines, IV medications, worried about him usually when he came in, whether he would be able to keep breathing or not. And he'd get better over the course of a week or 10 days and go back home. And a week later, he'd be back in the hospital. And I asked his mom what was happening at home. Was he taking his medications? Was there something else going on? She said, we live in a tiny one-room apartment. It's got mold on the walls. There are mice and roaches. Now, these are all factors that we know are very important drivers of the risk of childhood asthma. So I actually went and asked the attending physician if I could prescribe new housing. And he said, the prescription pad doesn't work that way. But you recognize the importance. So we tried to work with that mom to find a better apartment. But you have to think, we're paying many thousands of dollars for each of those hospital admissions when the real solution to that particular patient's problem was a better house.
You mentioned stakeholder meetings. In developing this plan, tell us about the stakeholder meetings that you've held in Montana.
We've spent a lot of time on the road. I think I've put more than 10,000 miles on my car in the last few months. So we have gone out to communities and met with local rural hospitals, critical access hospitals, small local health departments. We've had a number of meetings with tribes around the state and tribal health departments, tribal leadership. We have met with health experts at the state health department, county health departments. We've met with the major hospital systems and the state organizations that organize hospitals, primary care clinics, community health centers. So we've spent as much time as we possibly can getting to know the health of this state from all angles.
All right. When I read from the table of contents, you have You had peer-reviewed literature. You had a study of what other foundations did. You had stakeholder meetings and educational presentations to trustees. So the sum total of that leads to your strategic plan, fair?
Yes.
How important has the input of the stakeholders been in influencing your prioritization?
I think it's very, very important. I'll give you maybe just one example, which is we know when we look at the state statistics that many parts of the state, especially in the rural areas, are what are called health manpower shortage areas, places where there aren't enough health professionals to serve the needs of the community. And that's an important statistic. That could drive a foundation to think in terms of what's our strategy to get more people out there. But you really have to go to the local communities and understand what's going on there, what is driving those shortages, what are the specific challenges. So, for example, we've heard in some communities, one of the issues is that there are a lot of physicians and nurses nearing retirement, and they've had a mm-hmm. hard time bringing new people in to replace them. In other communities, for example, for the mental health system in rural areas, it is purely a matter of finances and resources. If you can't pay people enough, it's difficult to recruit.
Sure.
So it's a matter of connecting those numbers with the on-the-ground reality and then making a more specific plan to address those needs.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're talking with Dr. Aaron Wernham, CEO of the Montana Healthcare Foundation. Let's take a step back, sort of overview. I think generally we would look at Montana. We would think of it as a healthy place, big outdoors, people getting exercise, pretty clean air, overall healthy. Fair assessment?
That is a fair assessment. By one organization's rankings, the organization that puts out annual rankings of state health, and Montana ranked 22 out of 50 states. Some of the strengths were statewide, a relatively low prevalence of obesity and diabetes. That is, to your point, probably reflective of people eating pretty well and getting more exercise than the rest of the U.S. Some of the weak points, though, included high injury rate, and that may reflect drunk driving, people not using seatbelts or child restraints as often as in other parts of the country. Also, mental health problems. The state has had one of the highest suicide rates, if not the highest suicide rate in the country for quite a few years running.
Let's just stop there for a second, because we've done quite a few shows on mental illness. The work of NAMI comes to mind, National Alliance or Association for Mental Illness. Mm-hmm. Pretty dramatic shows from my standpoint, also with individuals who suffer mental illness. Why would a state which would, if you look around Montana, you say low stress, it isn't New York City, people you'd think would not under a terrible amount of pressure, visible pressure, what's going on here?
I think that's a really important question, and I'm not sure that we as a foundation have fully understand the answer yet. I think that there are a number of pieces that we certainly intend to work on. One is that mental illness is prevalent in every state. Some states are better equipped to deal with it and get to people earlier. So we really have found in some places, particularly in rural parts of the state, that there's a lack of services. So just getting people basic mental health services early on is important. We also know that childhood trauma, what are known now in the scientific literature as adverse childhood experiences, play a very, very important role. Montana, according to one national study, ranked quite high on adverse childhood experiences among our children.
We did a show on the ACE study, which was quite shocking to me. Can you remind me of when we say adverse childhood experiences, what we're talking about?
Really, I think the common sense way to look at it is just things that happen in childhood that you would think would be traumatic. It includes things that are quite common, like parents getting a divorce, parents being addicted to drugs or alcohol and drinking around their kids, violence in the home, that sort of thing. Things that children can rebound from, but they really add up. And the more of those that there are in the home, the more likely you are to have mental illness as well as many physical ailments later on in life.
All I remember from the show was the correlation was stunning to me. It included things like correlation with heart disease and cancer.
Absolutely.
Now, if I'm quoting you correctly, your thinking is part of the problem is lack of resources for early intervention.
That's fair. That is definitely one of the issues that has come up. By no means the only one, but one of the important ones.
Is there solid data that early intervention or relatively easy access to mental health professionals or services makes a difference for children's well-being in terms of mental health?
So let's define mental health clearly before I answer the question. I think when we talk about mental health, we are talking about the full spectrum of mental illness, but also drug and alcohol abuse and related problems. I think there is great evidence that early intervention can be very, very effective. We know, for example, that children at risk of suicide can be identified early based on behavior, based on school performance, and that interventions early on in a crisis can prevent that end result, which is so terrible.
Montana has a very high youth suicide rate relative to the nation. Fair?
Fair.
So what's going on? The implication of what you're saying is that we could be identifying more of these kids. You said they're identifiable by school behavior, etc. We end up with a high suicide rate. That suggests that we're not doing the job.
Well, let me tell you one group of kids that really caught our eye. The state does an annual survey called the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. When they looked at the results of that survey, it looks at a whole range of risk factors, drug and alcohol use, behavior problems, other health problems, depression. There's one group of kids that stood out with very, very concerning statistics, and that's high school students in the state's alternative high school programs. These are programs set up for kids who aren't generally doing well in regular school.
Dropouts.
Kids at risk for dropping out, kids who are pregnant, kids who may have had a behavior problem, been suspended, what have you. Among those kids, the rate of attempted suicide in the previous year was more than 20%.
Much
higher than the rest of the state. So we know that's one high-risk group of kids. We've already identified them, and yet we've also found that many of the alternative school programs lack resources and don't have counselors or other interventions that might help those kids get back on their feet. There are some very accessible examples from elsewhere in the country and from our early investigation, some successful examples in the state of programs that are trying to address the behavioral health needs, the mental illness and substance use needs of those kids. One model is called trauma-informed discipline. So rather than coming down harder and harder on these kids, actually trying to understand what's behind the behaviors and making them feel as if they're in a more safe and supported environment. Another is simply getting them the services. So making sure that teachers understand how to recognize a kid in crisis, making sure that when they do, they can get them into counseling promptly.
Is there solid evidence that strategy works?
Yes.
In the time we have left, let's shift to the grants you are currently offering, more than $1 million in grants, and you've identified three areas: behavioral health disorders, including mental illness and drug and alcohol addiction, American Indian Health, and Partnerships for Better Health. We don't have time, regrettably, to go into all of them in detail. Let's talk about American Indian Health. I noticed in the reading that the average life expectancy of American Indians in Montana is 50 years of age, more than 20 years less than the average population.
I do want to make one nuanced point, which is it's not exactly life expectancy. It's median age at death, which is a slightly different statistic.
Okay.
Still, the main point is it is a very, very concerning difference. And it reflects a lot of specific issues that we've heard about: higher rates of diabetes, higher rates of injury, higher rates of suicide. We know that on some of the reservations and for some urban Indians, poverty and unemployment are major drivers, and I've already talked to you about how those factors can affect health. We also know that there's historical trauma. There are issues that have come about through generations of history that are unquestionably affecting the health of those communities. The good thing is we have talked to some amazing leaders in tribal health and found great opportunities to address some of those needs. I don't pretend that we can turn the disparities around in a year of grant making. In fact, one of the tribal leaders we spoke with said it took us generations to get to the disparities we have, and it may take us quite some time to get healthier again. We intend to be in this for the long haul. Opportunities that we've seen range from helping work with tribes to strengthen the financing of the services they're trying to provide so they can extend them. We have one example from Fort Peck, where their health promotion disease prevention program has extended behavioral health services now to several schools on the reservations. They're actually providing dental care and some health care in the schools as well, and that's a very effective way to reach children at risk. We've heard from another reservation that actually has, from what we've seen, perhaps somewhat better health statistics, that sometimes it's going to the basics. It's making sure you're effectively billing and bringing in the revenue that you can from insurance so that you can pay providers well, so that you can hire really good providers. So we think this will take quite a few years of investment to help work with tribes to identify what specific needs do they have, what ideas do they have, how can we make the services that are available to them culturally based and more effective and based in their traditions as well. And I think that we can get there. It'll just take some time.
You suggest in relation to the tribes it may take some time to turn things around. The foundation is here for the long haul?
Yes, we will manage the trust, the funds that we have currently, sustainably. So we'll make grants based on the interest income and are intended to be here forever, in perpetuity.
Much of what you've said makes me think that the major focus, or a major focus of the foundation, is on causes of disease rather than just treating disease. Poverty, housing, transportation, these sorts of things that are, as you call them, upstream. Those are complicated things. What makes you think this level of resources that you have available can be effective in dealing with those kinds of problems?
Foundations are a unique part of the health system. We think in terms of doctors and hospitals, nurses, when
Right.
we think of the health system. What a foundation can do is allow anyone concerned with health, whether it's a nonprofit or a hospital or what have you, to take two steps back and think, how could we be doing this better? We have actually seen nationally some health systems beginning to think as far upstream as spending Medicaid dollars on housing so that when they discharge a homeless patient from a two-week-long ICU stay with pneumonia, they can actually go back to and not bounce back to the ER a week later with the same problem again. Some of this is actually pretty simple. We've seen, for example, one of the critical access hospital in Ennis just decided to hire a nurse care navigator to, instead of having her just taking care of patients all day, she calls their ER patients in follow-up to make sure they understand how to take their medicines, how to get to their specialty appointments, to make sure that they have enough food to eat, to make sure that they're safe in their homes and aren't at risk of falling and breaking the hip that they just had replaced. So some of these upstream influences are things that are really actually not that difficult if we think two steps outside the box and think a little bit creatively. And that's what the resources of a foundation can do.
Dr. Aaron Warnham, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.